Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, June 27, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, our teleform is on the recess appointment powers case decided yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court, the Noel Canning case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording the call today for use as a podcast in the future. We're very happy for this important case to welcome three experts to our call today. They are, in the order they're going to be speaking to you for opening remarks, Noel J. Francisco. He's a partner at the Jones Day Law Firm right here in Washington, D.C. He'll speak first. Second, we'll hear from Professor Michael B. Rappaport. He is the Hugh and Hazel Darling Foundation Professor of Law and Director of the Center for the Study of Constitutional Originalism at the University of San Diego Law School. And then finally, we'll hear from Professor Kristen E. Hickman. She's the Harlan Albert Rogers Professor of Law and the Associate Director of the Corporate Institute at the University of Minnesota School of Law. We're going to get opening remarks from each in turn of about 5 to 10 minutes. We might give Noel Francisco a few minutes extra because he's going to be giving some background on the case, then a little back and forth. But as always, we'll be turning to you for your questions from the audience, so please be ready with those questions when we get to that point in the program. And with that, Mr. Francisco, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean, very much. And I want to start out just by thanking my co-counsel in this case, the U.S. Chamber Litigation Center. We joined forces to serve as co-counsel to the Noel Canning Company in the Supreme Court. And I don't think we could have done everything we were able to do without the help and support of them all along the way. Let me start out by just giving our listeners a brief description of the case and what the court held. I'm going to assume that most people are generally familiar with it, so I'm going to try to avoid going into any excruciating detail, but I'll give enough background so that everybody who is only somewhat familiar with it has a sense for what happened, and then I'll offer a few comments on the different opinions that emerged. As you all probably recall, this case arose out of President Obama's really unique and unprecedented assertion of executive power in January 2012, where for the first time in American history, a president attempted to make recess appointments when the Senate was in fact convening sessions every 3 days. Those are the so-called pro forma sessions. Recess appointments are not new. Arguably unconstitutional recess appointments are not new. But what was new here was that this president took the recess appointments power further than any of his predecessors had ever gone, attempting to make appointments when the Senate was, under its rules, convening sessions on a regular basis. That's what led to this case, and that's what made our challenge to the president's recess appointments in this context uniquely vulnerable. And what we saw in the Supreme Court's decision yesterday was a resounding 9-0 rejection of the president's unprecedented assertion of executive power. I'll talk in a minute about the majority and the concurring opinions, which reached the same result, albeit through significantly different reasoning. But one point I'd like to emphasize is that the majority opinion, authored by Justice Breyer, joined by the other four liberal justices on the court, was a square and unequivocal rejection of the legal reasoning advanced by the Department of Justice's Office of Legal Counsel that purportedly attempted to justify these recess appointments. That Office of Legal Counsel opinion was based just about exclusively on the assertion that the president had the authority to declare that the Senate's sessions lawfully held every 3 days were constitutional shams. And the majority opinion offered by Justice Breyer, joined by Justices Kagan, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and also Justice Kennedy, resoundingly rejected that position. So let me give you just a thumbnail sketch of what the majority held for the court and what the concurrence articulated as its rationale for joining the judgment of that court. There were essentially three questions presented the resolution of any of which in our favor would have resulted in the invalidation of these recess appointments. The first question presented was, could the president make recess appointments during breaks that occurred within a Senate session? These are the so-called intra-session breaks. Or is that power limited to the break that falls in between the Senate's formal sessions? The second question was, assuming that the Senate is in recess at any given time, which vacancies are eligible for a recess appointment? The question would be, are all vacancies that happen to exist during a recess of the Senate eligible for recess appointments, or are the eligible vacancies limited to a subset of vacancies that exist during the Senate's recess? That is, those vacancies that not only exist during the recess of the Senate, but also that arose during the recess of the Senate. And then the third question presented goes to the validity of these pro forma sessions. Can the president make recess appointments when the Senate is convening sessions every 3 days, including so-called pro forma sessions in which it gavels into and out of session relatively quickly, but during which it is capable of conducting business if it wants to? The majority of the court, in an opinion authored by Justice Breyer, held that the president could make recess appointments during any substantial break in Senate action, regardless of whether that break fell between sessions or during a session, and could make those appointments to any vacancy that existed during that so-called recess. But Justice Breyer agreed with us on the third question presented, and he held that for a break to constitute a recess, it must be at least 3 days long, and for purposes of calculating that period, pro forma sessions were fully valid sessions. The Senate said they were valid sessions, and during those sessions, the Senate was in fact capable of conducting business if it wanted to. So what emerged from the majority opinion is essentially a three-part rule. The first part of the rule says that any break of 3 days or less is not a recess, period, full stop. That's not a recess. If there's a break between 4 and 10 days long, it is presumptively not a recess. We're not 100% sure what exactly the presumptively means. What it means is that it's probably not a recess unless the president has a really, really good reason for explaining why there was such an emergency that he had to act during a break of between 4 and 10 days. And for a break that is longer than 10 days, that is a recess during which the president can make recess appointments. But the critical part of that rule is Justice Breyer's holding that for purposes of calculating how long the Senate is or is not in session, it's up to the Senate to determine whether it's in session. So if the Senate says it's in session and holds these pro forma sessions every 3 days, as it was doing when the president made these recess appointments, there is no recess, and the president can make no recess appointments. The concurring justices, in an opinion authored by Justice Scalia, would have resolved this case quite differently in terms of their reasoning. They would have held that recess appointments were limited to inter-session recesses, that is, the formal recess that falls in between the Senate's formal sessions, and further, that the only vacancies that are eligible for recess appointments are those vacancies that happen to arise during the recess of the Senate. Justice Scalia grounded his opinion in the text and the original understanding of the clause. The majority and the dissent joined argument in terms of how historical practice played into this. The majority's view, in my judgment, was that we were probably right, and Justice Scalia was probably right on the text and original understanding of the clause, but that it was sufficiently ambiguous that historical practice was relevant, and the majority thought that the historical record was too strong to allow it to go the other way on those first two questions presented. Justice Scalia viewed the text and history quite differently. He viewed the text as unambiguous on both of the first two questions, and the history as ambiguous and arguable, and in that context, his view was that the the historical practice cannot overcome the unambiguous text and unambiguous original understanding of the clauses. So that's essentially how it came down. A 9-0 decision on the result, five justices ruling that the recess appointments are invalid under the third question presented involving the so-called pro forma sessions, four justices holding that the recess appointments were invalid under the first two questions presented, which go to the original understanding of the clause and when recess appointments can be made and which vacancies are eligible for recess appointments. To take a step back and just to give a couple of big picture comments on it, in my view, I know that Professor Rappaport has written extensively and powerful articles on the original understanding of the clause, and I think, you know, in my judgment, he's right on that. Those are the positions that we also articulated in this case. But I don't think that there is a lot of practical difference between the majority opinion and the opinion of the concurring justices. To be sure, they adopted very different ways to reach the same result. But going forward, I think both rules pretty much give the Senate back its authority in the appointments process, because under both sets of reasoning, it's now up to the Senate to determine under its rules when it's in recess, thus giving rise to the recess appointments power. So both of them, in terms of their bottom line result, and in my judgment, restore the constitutional order in which the president cannot make recess appointments in order to do an end run around Senate advice and consent. He maybe can do it when the Senate is truly unavailable, but he can't do it simply because the Senate does not want to confirm his nominees, and they get us to basically the same place. So although I would agree that Justice Scalia's opinion is more more doctrinally pure and, in my judgment, is correct, I am equally happy with the opinion that Justice Breyer issued, because I do think that it restores the constitutional order, if not necessarily in every jot and tittle of its reasoning, certainly in its bottom line rule. Dean, with that, I'll turn it over to Professor Rappaport.
Well, thanks, Noel. Although I was disappointed by the overall result in the Supreme Court, I kind of have a mixed reaction to the decision from the perspective of both originalism and the original meaning of the recess appointments clause. On the one hand, a majority decision by Justice Breyer is almost always a bad thing for originalism. And that was true in Noel Canning. The majority got the type of recess issue wrong, and it got the happen issue wrong for the first two issues that Noel talked about. But I can't even take solace in the majority's conclusion that the recess appointments were illegal, because I think it's likely that the pro forma sessions were not actually constitutional sessions. More on this in a minute. On the other hand, the originalist result came very close to winning. Got four votes. When I first wrote my article on the original meaning of the recess appointments clause in 2005, which set forth the position articulated by Justice Scalia in the concurrence, virtually no one adopted the view that I defended. And even after the D.C. Circuit decided Noel Canning, an astute observer of the Supreme Court's separation of powers jurisprudence, Professor Peter Shane, said on a Federalist podcast, exactly like this one, that he would buy me dinner if anyone other than Justice Thomas adopted my view of the happen issue. Yet four justices adopted this view. Moreover, there was good reason to be skeptical that Justices Alito and Roberts would sign on. Both of them have histories in the executive branch and therefore might be hesitant to limit the president's recess appointment power. And both of them have emphasized questions of practice, with Justice Alito especially seeming to be skeptical of originalism. Yet both join the opinion with no reservation. Now, moving from originalism to limiting executive power, the majority's decision is a little bit better. It does mean that the Senate can stop recess appointments by holding pro forma sessions, Noel was saying. But I'm not so sure that's going to work out so well unless both houses are controlled by the opposing party of the president. If the House and the Senate are controlled by different parties, then the House controlling the president's party is not going to agree to a pro forma session. Right? So they're going to have, so the House, for example, one House might say we're going to continue to meet every 3 days, and the other one says, no, we want to meet in 30 days from now. They'll have a disagreement as to the time of their adjournment, and possibly, we don't have much experience with this, but the Constitution appears to give the president the power to determine the length of the adjournment, which would mean, so if the two houses disagree and the president steps in to resolve the dispute, which the Constitution seems to give him that power, then he's going to say, oh, well, we'll meet again, the two houses will meet again in more than 10 days. And then, of course, he can make a recess appointment. Justice Breyer's opinion was obviously not an originalist opinion. You know, and as with most non-originalists, he attempted to camouflage this by claiming that the language was ambiguous. But I think there are two problems with this. First, he was way too quick to decide that the language was ambiguous. It's not enough to say, oh, there were two meanings of recess at the time of the Constitution. That's true enough. But it's pretty clear that the ordinary meaning, which would allow even a 30-minute recess to count as a recess, was not employed in the Constitution. Once you looked at the additional circumstances, these so-called ambiguities get largely resolved. Second, Justice Breyer's opinion looks to purpose based on either modern circumstances or historical circumstances as it suits his argument. For example, he attempts to justify having different lengths for intersession recess appointments and intra-session recess appointments on the ground that the intra-session recess appointments need to have at least a year to allow an appointment to be made. But this makes sense, if it does at all, only under the assumption that we live in the modern world where appointments take 3 to 4 months to make and sometimes take 6 months to make. But at the same time, Justice Breyer allows a 10-day break to count as a recess. But in the modern world where appointments take 3 to 6 months, a mere 10-day break is not enough to justify a recess appointment. If it makes sense, it only makes sense in the 18th century world where appointments were made much more quickly. So he's shifting between the 18th century and the 21st century, depending on which kind of purpose argument he wants to make. Thus, Justice Breyer's purpose methodology is so flexible that it allows him to reach whatever results he likes. And since text has such a limited role for him, there's very little constraint on where he wants to go. Finally, let me explain briefly, and this is also briefly, why I question the majority's conclusion that the pro forma sessions counts. Pro forma session counts as a real session. A pro forma session involves two or three senators meeting for a minute or two. They hit the gavel, a minute later they hit the gavel again, typically. But those senators would not have a quorum to do business. The Constitution establishes that a majority of the senators constitutes a quorum. One or two does not. And therefore, if they don't have a quorum, I don't think they're allowed to act. And they're not really in session. I seriously question the legislation. I don't fully understand how it gets enacted. But if two senators are up there and they pass legislation, I think that's unconstitutional. But there's a lot more to be said about this matter. But the short of it is that I think it's hard to conclude that the Senate is in business to do that the Senate is in session to do business without a quorum. Okay, let me pass it on to you, Kristen.
Thanks, Mike. And some of my comments are going to reflect a few of the comments that Noel and Mike made. But let me go forward with them anyway. I know that this case will be and is being painted by some people as an instance of pragmatism trumping a cramped and unrealistic formalism or originalism. But in that regard, Justice Breyer's opinion strikes me as representing a sort of faux pragmatism that only lawyers and ideologues can love or find convincing. On the one hand, he is right that we have had quite a number of recess appointments in the past that would have been unconstitutional under the D.C. circuits and the dissent's interpretation of the recess appointments clause. And I think that is why he writes the opinion the way he does. He simply does not want to say that presidents have been violating the Constitution for all of these years. But Justice Breyer can't come out and say that that's his reason for finding the case outcome as he does. So instead, to justify giving the president a broad theoretical recess appointment power that would accommodate most, if not all, of those past recess appointments, Justice Breyer finds ambiguity in the Constitution's use of the words "the" and "happen," and relies on that ambiguity to justify emphasizing historical interpretation and practice, as well as the purpose of the recess appointments clause, which he describes as the president needing to be able to ensure the continued functioning of the government whenever the Senate is unavailable to act on his appointments. When I described Justice Breyer's opinion last night to a highly educated, relatively sophisticated, but non-lawyer friend, he snorted that quibbling over the meaning of words like "the" and "happen" is why people hate lawyers. Or as a judge I know like to say, some people will find ambiguity in a stop sign. I agree with Mike that Justice Breyer got to ambiguity way too fast. I've seen him spend a lot more time in Chevron opinions, applying various tools of statutory construction to avoid finding ambiguity. So that part of his opinion seems a little strained. And I find Justice Breyer's historical account, and particularly his reliance on the purpose of the recess appointments clause, also to be incredibly strained. I really haven't tracked all of the ins and outs of the history myself, but Justice Breyer seems to be using history not only to demonstrate that presidents have been making recess appointments for a long time, but also to illustrate the Senate needing to be available so that the president can keep the government functioning, supposedly finding a consensus about that need. So, for example, at one point, he relies quite heavily on a passage from a report of the Senate Judiciary Committee from 1905 as defining the phrase "the recess" in functional terms that emphasize the Senate's unavailability during any recess, whether intersession or intrasession. Yet not only was that report criticizing a set of recess appointments made by Teddy Roosevelt, it was written in 1905 when most of America still relied on letters and telegraphs for communication and on trains and horses for transportation. So sure, in that era, any adjournment of the Senate really did make the Senate unavailable for consultation. But that's not the world we live in now. The idea that the Senate is ever really unavailable, or for that matter that the government's functioning would be imperiled by the amount of time it takes to consult the Senate about an appointment, is just implausible. Similarly, in his discussion of the meaning of the word "happen," Justice Breyer argues that restricting recess appointments further would prevent the president from making any recess appointment that arose before a recess, no matter who the official, no matter how dire the need, no matter how uncontroversial the appointment, and no matter how late in the session the office fell vacant. But what exactly does Justice Breyer expect to happen? What possible set of events could happen in the limited amount of time that Congress adjourns these days that couldn't be handled by the army of remaining government officials, particularly given that the Vacancies Act usually allows the president to fill these sorts of vacancies with temporary acting administrators? For that matter, if something so dire were to occur that we just had to have a new appointment that quickly, surely such dire circumstances would lead the Senate to cut short whatever vacation it is enjoying to hurry back to Washington. The theme of Senate unavailability during its various adjournments is what really drives Justice Breyer's reasoning. But the fact is that recess appointments in recent decades haven't been a consequence of the Senate being unavailable to consider the president's appointments. Rather, they've been a consequence of the Senate refusing to confirm particular nominees who have been controversial. Whether rightly or wrongly, the Senate doesn't have completely clean hands here either. But the entire premise of Justice Breyer's opinion on the unavailability of the Senate just rings false. Getting back then to Justice Breyer's preference of not declaring long-standing government practices as unconstitutional, to a great extent, I find Justice Breyer's opinion here very similar to his opinion in the Free Enterprise Fund case concerning the president's removal power a few years ago. In both cases, Justice Breyer's emphasis seemed to be on trying to interpret the Constitution to uphold long-standing existing practices in general, complete with appendices reflecting a sort of pseudoscientific attempt to back up his view with data. In both cases, the subtext of Justice Breyer's opinion seemed to be that if a practice is well established in government as it exists, then the practice must be okay. This approach gets cast as a pragmatic and restrained approach, for the court's refusal to interfere drastically with the status quo. But the problem with this approach is that particularly in a system in which we have a variety of justiciability limitations that keep the courts from considering issues until they are properly brought as a case or controversy, and we have a Supreme Court that only takes a small number of cases each year, it often takes decades before a serious constitutional question gets addressed. And of course, by then, the practice in question has been around for a long time and is thus de facto settled. So sure, the Republic hasn't fallen, but that doesn't mean we haven't lost something. I tend to think of it sort of this way. You can destroy a boulder by blowing it up with explosives. But over time, you can just as effectively destroy a boulder by putting it where the tide can get at it and letting the water wear it away slowly until there's nothing left. And the latter is what I think an approach like Justice Breyer's does to the Constitution. Regardless, as a more immediate and practical matter, it seems to me that we're right that recess appointments are at least somewhat on the wane, less because of this case than because of last fall's change in the Senate's rules with respect to cloture in the context of recess appointments and appointments generally. The old cloture rule required 60 senators to agree to end debate before the Senate could hold a confirmation vote, with the result that even when the same party controlled the presidency and the Senate, a minority of senators could block presidential appointments. That was a common occurrence during the administrations of both Presidents Obama and George W. Bush, although it's not what happened in this case. In November of last year, though, a majority of the senators voted to change the cloture rule to allow a simple majority of 51 votes to end debate with respect to most judicial and all executive branch appointments. Only Supreme Court appointments were excluded from that rule change. And as a result of the rule change, so long as the same party controls the presidency and the Senate, I doubt we will see very many recess appointments. Where the Noel Canning decision becomes important is when the different party, when we have different parties that hold the presidency and the Senate, which was the case with respect to the appointments at issue in Noel Canning and will undoubtedly occur again in the future. If not after this fall's elections, then at some other point in time. Noel Canning tells the Senate what it has to do to prevent the president from making recess appointments, hold pro forma sessions. That's a hassle, but I have no doubt that the Senate will be able to do just that, at least to a degree. But at the very least, as a practical matter, I think Noel is right that Justice Breyer has given the Senate a helpful tool to protect its prerogative. But Justice Breyer's opinion also sets us up not only for a series of pro forma Senate sessions, but for the kind of arcane quibbling over procedural rules that average Americans just hate to see out of Washington. Justice Breyer's opinion is pretty unequivocal about that 3-day break never being sufficient. But the 10-day limit is just a presumption, and it's a rebuttable presumption. Justice Breyer suggests that a national catastrophe would be sufficient to overcome that presumption, but he doesn't define what constitutes a national catastrophe, nor does he say that only a national catastrophe is sufficient to overcome the presumption. And facing a Senate controlled by the opposing party, one can easily imagine presidents claiming all sorts of reasons to overcome Justice Breyer's presumption and justify recess appointments, and we can just see our representatives in Washington and the president arguing back and forth about whether the president has adequate justification to justify recess appointments under the Supreme Court's opinion. Moreover, Justice Breyer spends lots of time in his opinion on the arcana of Senate rules. And Mike already talked about what happens if the two houses disagree over the length of an adjournment. It's precisely this kind of arcane gamesmanship that brings many Americans to have nothing but contempt for elected officials in both parties of Congress. And I don't think that, setting that kind of situation up is very pragmatic at all. With that, I'll turn it back over to Dean.
Thank you very much, Professor Hickman. I want to do a couple things here. First, I do want to go back to Noel Francisco and Professor Rappaport, but first I want to open the floor to questions and let people begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we start off with four questions, so let's keep that in mind as I revert to Noel Francisco for any response he might have. Go ahead, Mr. Francisco.
Sure, Dean. Thanks. You know, I can't say that I have any strong disagreement with anything that's been said so far. You know, I clerk for Justice Scalia. I tend to think that that approach is the better one. On the other hand, I think something that judges, including conservative judges, often confront is what do you do when you confront a long line of precedent? Here we did not have any judicial precedent, but I guess, you know, some would view the historical practice as precedent of some validity. What do you do when you confront that kind of precedent, but then a new situation where you have an opportunity to return the ball to essentially where it would be if you hadn't had that precedent? You basically have one of two choices. You can either sweep the precedent aside and adopt both the rule and the reasoning that reflects the proper understanding of the Constitution. That, I think, is the preference of me. That's the preference of Justice Scalia. That's the preference of a lot of folks on this call. Alternatively, you can try to craft a rule that maybe is not grounded in the proper understanding of the Constitution as originally made, but produces a result that is pretty close. That's often what we see courts do. Think the Court's Commerce Clause jurisprudence, where they've adopted this economic, non-economic distinction for what is a proper regulation of commerce. That's not necessarily the best reading of the text of the Commerce Clause, but it's an effort, I think, by judges to craft a rule that at least returns a large number of cases to what the clause was originally meant to do. In a way, I think that's a way to understand the rule that Justice Breyer crafted. I am not asserting that Justice Breyer is an originalist or that that was his goal, but it's a way to understand and justify why courts sometimes do craft rules that don't themselves reflect necessarily the proper understanding of the text of the Constitution as it was originally written, but do craft rules that get towards results that are close to what would have been allowed under the Constitution properly construed. That's the only thing I'd say, but you know, it's not like I have a strong disagreement with anything that's been said on this call. You know, I think Justice Scalia was right on the two questions he addressed. I think Justice Breyer was right on the third question, but not the first two questions. I think that a result in our favor on any of the questions does a lot to restore the proper constitutional order governing recess appointments.
Let me ask you one quick question before I turn to Professor Rappaport, and that is, I know Justice Scalia did not find any vagaries or ambiguity in the text. If he had, is he then content to resort to historical practice?
Well, I think that Justice Scalia would, even if the text, you know, I think he would always resort to the right kind of historical practice. And the right kind of historical practice is essentially an unbroken chain of practice that starts with the founding. Not you don't have any of that here. On both of the first two questions presented, take, for example, the happens issue, the second issue. At the time of the founding, everyone who addressed the issue agreed with the position that Justice Scalia took. What you had afterwards were presidents starting in the 1820s taking the very self-serving position that the text was ambiguous and hence they would adopt a construction that maximized their power. And you had the Senate doing that against pretty strong, you had the presidents doing that against pretty strong Senate resistance, including a Senate law passed in, I think, 1860 prohibiting pay to any recess appointee who was appointed to a vacancy that arose other than during the Senate's recess. So here you don't have the kind of history that I think Justice Scalia would find persuasive if the text were ambiguous, because the most relevant history, that right at the time of the founding, cuts in favor of the position he adopted.
Professor Rappaport?
Yeah, so Noel talks about the importance the various judges, two various judges of practice or precedent. And I think that's right, to an extent. In this case, you know, the practice over time is up and down. It's shifting. And there's different positions on it and it changes. So it's kind of hard to know what the practice is, right? That's one of the problems with relying on practice. How do you characterize events that are ambiguous and the like? So I don't actually think practice doesn't go that far for me. Now, it is true there's an idea that goes back to Madison, I think that actually Justice Breyer even mentions, that in cases where the language is unclear, practice will liquidate the meaning of that unclear provision, and you'll get a clear meaning, and then everyone ought to follow that. But as Noel sort of mentions and adverts to, the early practice with respect to both of these issues, the type of recess issue and the happen issue, tends to be the Justice Scalia position on these things. And so if you were going to have a liquidation of the meaning, I actually think that cuts, if it cuts in any direction, cuts towards the Justice Scalia view. What ends up happening is, and if you go through the practice, and I've written an article that looks at this in exhaustive detail, that what ends up happening is there's a practice, and whenever the president gets told no, they just wait. And over time, then they come back and ignore the prior practice. So now we've got practice that ignores prior practice. Do you respect that practice? Justice Breyer does, but it gets complicated. Now, Kristen raises the point, and I think it's quite interesting that maybe Justice Breyer doesn't want to say that presidents have been acting illegally for hundreds of years. And that may be, there may be other things going on, but that may be. I know Kristen is not defending this, but defending Justice Breyer here, but I think that's a big mistake. It's very important. I can give a strong functionalist reason for the Supreme Court to say when presidents have been acting illegally, that they've been acting illegally. It's very important to constraining the president. That's one of the few things that can constrain presidents. And that is, you know, a Supreme Court opinion. If you're unwilling to do that, then of course we don't get that constraint. So I think that's a big mistake. I guess I just want to I'd like to conclude these remarks, I guess, but by sort of asking, what about this quorum point? I know that the Justice Breyer said, oh, well, we don't inquire into a quorum. And maybe that's right with respect to the judiciary, although I have real problems with that as well. But that's, but isn't it unconstitutional for the Senate to take a pro, to actually do something when they have a pro forma session? And then wouldn't it then also be then the conclusion that they don't have a real session going on if they're not allowed to do anything?
Well, I do want to turn to the audience for their questions, but before we do that, let me make a quick programming announcement. This is the end of the term, and we've got our schedule sort of in flux, but we have been able to schedule a teleform conference call on Monday. That's Monday, June 30th, the last day of the term. At 1 p.m. Eastern time, we'll have a panel of four experts discussing the Coakley case and the Hobby Lobby case. So that's going to be a 90-minute teleform conference call trying to tackle two cases. The Hobby Lobby case, of course, is the HHS mandate case that is expected to come out Monday. And the Coakley case is the First Amendment abortion clinic buffer zone case that has already come out. So that is Monday at 1 p.m. But today, of course, we're talking about Noel Canning. And with that, let me see if we can turn to our audience for our first question.
Hi, this is Kurt Levy at Committee for Justice. I wanted to slightly disagree with the argument that, you know, there's probably not much practical difference between the effects of the majority opinion and the concurrence, and get a reaction. You know, that's probably true with regard to the will of the majority, but you know, it's probably not true with the you know, with regard to the ability of the minority to stop a nominee. You know, assuming the president's party controls the Senate, they can say that they're in recess, and then there's really nothing the minority can do. Now, you know, you could counter-argument would be that since the nuclear option was invoked, there's probably not that much the minority can do, but there still are some things they can do, and we don't know if the nuclear option is going to, well, we don't know if the judicial filibuster is permanently gone, and at very least, you know, for example, with judicial nominees, you know, there's blue slipping. I mean, that's a very effective way of the minority stopping nominees, and you know, that's gone if the majority can just declare a recess and allow recess appointments. So anyway, I just wanted to get a reaction to that.
Sure, Noel Francisco here, and you make a very good point. The my belief that there's not much of a practical difference turns on the fact that there no longer is a filibuster against presidential appointees. If there were a filibuster, then there is a difference because you're exactly right. When there's a filibuster, the minority has the authority to prevent the appointments, but doesn't have the authority to trigger a pro forma session. So in that instance, I think there would be a difference. If I could also just briefly address Professor Rappaport's point about the validity of the Senate acting in pro forma sessions. I mean, I'll let everyone decide for themselves whether they think it's in fact constitutional, but the way the Senate works is that it operates under a presumption that a quorum exists unless somebody makes a quorum call and proves that a quorum doesn't exist. So if you look at the Senate journals on during every one of these pro forma sessions, it doesn't say there are only two members present. It simply notes that it reflects the fact that they're in session and that nobody established the absence of a quorum. That's essentially how the Senate operates on a daily basis, pursuant to the presumption that a quorum exists. That's why if you turn on C-SPAN on any given day, you're not going to see 51 senators on the Senate floor. You're going to see somebody standing, a senator standing at the dais, accompanied by a retinue of Senate staff, passing laws and confirming nominees through a process called unanimous consent, where the senator standing on the podium asks if anybody objects to the passage of a particular law or the confirmation of a particular nominee, and hearing no objection, probably because there's nobody else on the floor to object, it passes by unanimous consent pursuant to the presumption that a quorum exists. But as far as the Senate's records show, there was a quorum during every pro forma session. The only way you could second guess that is if you thought that reviewing C-SPAN tapes were admissible evidence in determining whether or not the Senate's journals and records were accurate.
Professor Rappaport or Kristen Hickman?
I'm prepared to leave it at that.
this would get us a little bit of a field, but the Constitution says you have to have a quorum, and it's a little bit of a problem that the Senate decides it doesn't want to follow that arrangement. You know, the Supreme Court has said that you can have any rule that has a reasonable relation, and actually in a quorum case they said as long as the rule has a reasonable relation to the constitutional provision, then that's okay. And so you don't have to be constantly figuring out whether you have a quorum every 10 minutes if someone walks in or walks out, if there's a bunch of people in the Senate. But where there's only one person or two people there, and it's obvious to everyone that you don't have a quorum, I don't think that's a reasonable relation to the quorum provision. But anyway, so we could go on about this for a long time, but I'll just leave it at that.
And we've got two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call here.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. This, of course, raises the problem of, okay, now we have a Supreme Court decision, but now what? Because we have a long line of decisions that have been made unlawfully, including the Senate not having a quorum or other House not having a quorum. And what do we do about those purported decisions and the effects they may have had retroactively? The Brady bill, for example, was passed with only three senators on the floor, and people have been prosecuted under it and are serving now in prison. So, what is the impact of that supposed to be? The original standard of due process was that if there was not a proper appointment of an official, all of his acts were null and void, as far back as he's purported to have served. Yet nobody's willing to actually overturn the decisions made by unlawfully appointed officials. So, we need to decide going forward what we are going to do to actually not only remedy but prevent this kind of thing from happening in the future. And one might be a rule that requires that for every vote in the House or Senate, that a listing be provided of who was present during the vote.
Responses?
Well, I'll take at least part of that. The quorum in the House or the Senate notwithstanding, at least one consequence of this particular case is that there are a whole lot of NLRB decisions that will be invalid as a result of this case, including Noel Canning's. Now, that said, so Noel Canning and others like Noel Canning get a do-over in front of the National Labor Relations Board, but the board will be able to rely on the record of evidence that was developed before. Noel Canning and other litigants will be able to present presumably more evidence or arguments than they didn't make last time, but there's really nothing stopping the NLRB from reaching the same decisions that it made before. But then and at least in Noel Canning's case, the D.C. Circuit said that once we got past the appointments issue, that the finding of the NLRB was supported by substantial evidence. So we'll see what happens as all of that unfolds, but it's not completely lacking. It's not that there's no remedy whatsoever, because at least people whose decisions were made by improperly appointed officials will now have the opportunity to have those decisions remade by properly appointed ones. Now, I did see one discussion talking about apparently because of the way that Justice Breyer and the majority decided the case because of the way this came out. Apparently there was some question about whether Craig Becker's appointment to the NLRB had been consistent with the recess appointments clause, and because the Senate had been out for more, was out for more than 10 days when Craig Becker was appointed through a recess appointment, his recess appointment will be presumably considered valid, so any decisions he participated in will be considered valid as well. So that's at least partially responsive.
Professor Rappaport or Noel Francisco?
Well, you know, this problem of what do you do about prior acts of illegality or prior mistakes is a very complicated one. And so you have the question of precedent sometimes. So if one thinks, for example, the New Deal Commerce Clause precedents were wrong, should an originalist go back to the original meaning and basically the whole modern government, modern federal government, becomes unconstitutional? So you have those kind of questions, and I've got another paper that talks about what we should do with respect to these precedent matters. Now, this is a little bit different than precedent, right? It's prior actions. But I guess all I want to say here is that even if, and there's a strong inclination on the part of people for both separation of powers reasons and otherwise to say, once the Senate says it has a law passed and the House says it has a law passed, that we accept that. Even if you had that view, that still wouldn't mean that going forward, the Supreme Court ought to be saying it's perfectly okay not to have a quorum, because that's what this opinion seems to suggest, and you know, that's a problem for the future, not just a problem about the past.
Well, and I take it the everything we're talking about here today would obtain to the appointment made the same day as the NLRB appointments, that is the appointment of the CFPB director. That's still under some cloud, I take it.
That's my understanding, particularly since there's apparently some question about whether a newly created position constitutes the same thing as a vacancy with respect to an existing position, and that question wasn't addressed at all.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller question left, and then our lines are open.
Thank you very much. Wayne Abernathy here with American Bankers Association. Very much appreciate the discussion. Very illuminating. I have a question that goes to the practicality issues that have been discussed, and I only raise it because it's been mentioned twice in the discussion today, and that's with regard to what happens when you get a disagreement between one house and the other house as to length of recess, and there was some suggestion that, well, then you're thrown into limbo or something. It seems to me that Section 5 of Article 1 actually solves that problem. It says that no house can be in recess for more than 3 days without the consent of the other. So if there is no consent from one house or the other, then the default in the Constitution seems to be you can't go out for more than 3 days. I wonder if you all see that the same way I do.
Well,
hey, Wayne,
absolutely...
Noel Francisco here. I think that you're exactly right in terms of analyzing how that clause works, and that is pretty much how Justice Breyer, I think, got to that three-day rule. It also explains why the House of Representatives has the authority to essentially prevent recess appointments by refusing to consent to a Senate adjournment of longer than 3 days. If the House refuses to allow the Senate to adjourn for more than 3 days, the Senate has no choice but to convene sessions every 3 days, whether pro forma or otherwise. And if it's doing that, the President can't make recess appointments under Justice Breyer's reasoning. There is one slight caveat to this, and it may turn out not to be slight because it's never happened before. Under a different provision of the Constitution, when the two houses of Congress disagree on the question of an adjournment, they can bring it to the President, and the President can force an adjournment. It's what used to be called a prorogation, if I'm pronouncing that right, during British parliamentary times. And under Justice Breyer's reasoning, it's possible that under that clause, which to my knowledge has actually never been used, it's an open question whether the president, on a disagreement between the two houses, can force a longer than 3-day adjournment.
Yeah, that's Article 2, Section 3.
Okay.
Yeah, and if you read the language, and I'll just quote it for you now, and in case of disagreement between them, that is the two houses, with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he shall think proper. So I don't even necessarily think they have to bring it to him.
Yeah.
He could probably, you know, so and then he can say, all right, 2 weeks, and here are these recess appointments, by the way.
That's a very astute observation. Like I said, never been used before, so if it ever does come down to that, I imagine we'll be taking a deep dive into the meaning of that clause as well.
Somebody will get tenure off of writing that article.
We've got about 3 or 4 minutes left and one question pending, so let's take a final question here if we can.
Hi, this is Nelson Lund from George Mason Law School. I would have thought, just looking at the text of the Constitution, that the only way to reconcile these two provisions on adjournment is to say that the provision in Article 2 has to do with how long the adjournment will be, not with whether there will be an adjournment. Does anybody have any response to that?
Well, I think it could be read that way, and I have to think more about it. But I don't think it needs to be read that way in order to reconcile the two. The first clause basically says neither house can go off without the consent of the other one for more than 3 days. So it has a perfectly independent meaning of the presidential aspect to it, in the sense that you're not allowed to leave for 10 days on your own. It means you've got to get the consent of the other one. So that then brings you into a situation where their consent does not occur, where they can't reach an agreement, and then the president steps in. So I don't think you have to read them in the way, I mean, you might read them the way you suggest, Nelson, but you don't necessarily have to do that. They have clear, independent, and non-conflicting meanings in the way I just suggested.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, you can see exactly how this would come up, right? Because it's going to come up when one party controls the Senate and then the other party controls both the presidency and the House. And of course the House is perfectly happy in that context to have the president decide how long Congress will be in adjournment. So I'm not even sure you'd have, you know, what you'd end up with is some members of Congress saying, yes, the president completely has this power. And we just end up arguing over the meaning of this obscure clause.
So am I understanding you correctly to say when the Constitution says neither house shall adjourn for more than 3 days without the consent of the other, that means that they can adjourn with the consent of the president?
No.
Is that basically what it comes to?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way. You could put it that way, I suppose. But what it basically says is, first of all, you're supposed to reach agreement with one another. But if you can't reach agreement,
no, that's not what that's not what it says. It says you can't do it without the consent of the other. It seems to give each of them a veto. It doesn't say try to come to an agreement.
It says that either one. It says that they can't do it without the consent of the other, but it also says in cases of disagreement, the president can step in. So, I mean, I don't, you know, one says I want only a 3-day recess. The other one says I want a 10-day recess. How can the president not step in that case?
That's what I meant, that it has to do with the time, not with whether to adjourn. The time,
but these are
the length of the adjournment, not whether they can adjourn.
But a 3-day adjournment, which is what the pro forma sessions do, is still a length of an adjournment. It's still an adjournment. So there is a disagreement at the time.
Yeah, okay.
All right. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We are out of time. This has been a fascinating discussion. I want to thank our experts today, Noel Francisco and Professors Kristen Hickman and Michael Rappaport. We certainly appreciate your time, and we certainly appreciate you joining us today. To our audience, a reminder that our next scheduled telephone conference call is Monday, June 30th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be tackling two cases, the Coakley case and the Hobby Lobby case, one decided, one to be decided Monday. That's our expectation. And then on Tuesday, we'll be talking about the Harris v. Quinn case. That's the domestic unionization of domestic workers case that will also be decided on Monday. We'll be talking about that case on Tuesday. But until that next Teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.